I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Top conservatives are meeting today at the home of a prominent movement leader in Virginia to plan how to take back the White House and perhaps the party. Which way will the GOP go after the party losses this week? Centrist Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty said Republicans can't be the party that does so poorly with Hispanics, African Americans, women. This has to be a more pragmatic party. Well, we have two conservative voices today. Let's start with Adam Brickley, the 22-year-old blogger who launched the website Sarah Palin for VP and now feels she'd make a good president. Adam, welcome.
Hey, good to talk to you.
And Adam, we've spoken about this on the program. You started that website after a personal Wikipedia search for some Republican woman to offset Hillary Clinton. What do you say to people who are now saying, I mean, you were one of her biggest and earliest backers, she was in large part responsible for McCain's loss?
Well, number one, I don't think you can say that because Obama's campaign was so well-funded. He had such a movement behind him. And no, I don't think that's true. I think actually Sarah Palin's in large part responsible for McCain coming as close as he did. Without her, the Republican base would not have been half as revved up as it was.
Well, do you agree that there's a schism in the party over the conservative base that backs, as you do, Palin? And what was once the McCain wing, the more moderate wing?
I see the potential for that. You know, I'm going to have to wait and see what pans out over the next year or so to see whether that actually develops. You know, I like to call myself an across-the-board conservative. I'm fiscally conservative, socially conservative, and conservative on national security. And really, that was half the reason I started this whole Palin movement, is I was looking for people who could really unite all the values of all those wings of the party, which is what Reagan did, which is why we were so successful with that. And I personally still think Sarah Palin can do that.
So you don't think there needs to be a new direction for the party that is more centrist after McCain's loss? Some people said if he had run as the moderate he was even just a year ago, he might have won.
Well, listen, I don't think we need a total new direction. We still live in a center-right country on most scales. What I like to watch right now is the Conservative Party over in Britain. And on one hand, they're moving to the center, but that's really not, I think, what's responsible for their resurgence. It's not that we have the wrong views. It's that we're talking about the wrong issues. The issues people want to talk about more today are economic issues, quality of life issues, health care issues. It's not that we need to refocus our agenda. It's that we need to learn to talk about the issues people want to talk about in the lingo that they want to talk about it.
Adam Brickley, the young conservative blogger who launched the website Sarah Palin for VP. Adam Brickley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Matthew Cottinetti. He's associate editor of the right-leaning magazine, The Weekly Standard. Matthew, you just heard from Adam Brickley, thinks that the party can still be big tent, but what are you feeling? I mean, do you feel fissures?
Well, I'm not sure how many fissures there are in the Republican Party anymore. I think the party that's left after the 2008 election is relatively unified and shares a few characteristics. It's a rural party located in the South and Midwest. It's a party that's white. It's a party that's religious. It's also a party that tends not to be credentialed or degreed, for example. McCain did very well among white voters in particular without college degrees. It's very unified. It's the Sarah Palin party. It's a Mike Huckabee party. But it doesn't share a lot with the voters who supported Barack Obama in 2008.
Here's George Voinovich of Ohio saying the Republican Party has to unite the country, in his quotes implying that the campaign had been divisive. We're hearing that there are fissures, although I've heard you say that, in fact, that moderate wing of the party, the Rockefeller Republican wing, really doesn't exist that much anymore.
No, it doesn't. You know, Bill Bishop, the writer, calls it the big sort. And what's been happening over a generation and is now even becoming more pronounced is that the two parties are sorting by ideology. And, of course, certain people with ideologies also share certain characteristics. And the Democrats' great achievement over the past 2 years is that they've been able to reach out to the center. And I think that has less to do with the Republican Party's failings, which are many, than certain particular failings, such as George Bush's dismal popularity and also the state of the economy.
But given that setup, which way do you think the Republican Party should go now? Should it go more to the center to compete with the Democrats for those voters, or should it hew further to the right and get harder?
Well, conservatives aren't going to win anything if they don't reach out to the center. It's a question of how do you do that. You know, Ronald Reagan was able to capture the center without giving up any of his principles. I think the real lesson of the last few years is that it's outside factors that determine our politics. McCain was winning. up until around the end of September, when Lehman Brothers failed and the global economy began its slow motion collapse.
Well, there are external factors, but former Republican Congressman Mickey Edwards says the conservative movement has strayed from its founding principles. And you yourself had a moment of reconsideration. You wrote the book, The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine. And you were surprised to find that Republican Party operatives were getting rich off conservative power. Essentially, an idealistic movement had become a career corrupt. So there are certainly criticism.
Absolutely. It doesn't help when Republican congressmen are trapped in these wheeling and dealing scandals. But what I'm saying is Mickey Edwards, he's a nice guy. He wrote an interesting book. That's not going to affect voters' behavior in the years to come. What's going to affect voters' behavior is the image that the Republican Party presents to the people, and also how well President-elect Obama fares in office. If he has a very successful term, the Republican Party is in deep trouble for possibly decades. If he does not have a successful first term, then it's very conceivable to me that the Republicans will be back in power in the presidency in 4 years.
Matthew Cottinelli, by the way, we asked Adam Brickley earlier, do you think Sarah Palin, an ultra-conservative, was a drag on the ticket?
I think that the voters did not like Sarah Palin, who said that Sarah Palin was a factor in their vote and who voted for Barack Obama as a consequence. I think they were probably going to vote for Barack Obama anyway. Sarah Palin was just an additional reason. If you asked the Republican voters if they thought Sarah Palin mattered, those who did overwhelmingly supported her, thought that she was a plus, a huge, giant plus. I do not think John McCain lost the election because Sarah Palin.
Matthew Cottinelli, associate editor of the magazine The Weekly Standard. Matthew, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A series of bomb blasts across Baghdad today killed at least 4 people and injured more than 20 others in the 4th consecutive day of violence. Violence is down nearly 90% from late 2006. That was just before the U.S. troop surge. It was also before the Sunni Awakening, the U.S.-backed Sunni uprising against al-Qaeda foreign forces in Iraq. Well, our next guest is one of those concerned that in backing the Sunni Awakening, the U.S. may also be unwittingly arming a new insurgency. If, after U.S. troops leave, the Sunnis turn their firepower on the sitting Iran-backed Shiite government. What to do in Iraq? It's one of the main challenges facing President-elect Barack Obama. Peter Galbraith's latest book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Yeah, Peter is former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, also a former advisor to the Kurds in northern Iraq, and son of the late John Kenneth and Kitty Galbraith. And Peter, we welcome you to the studio with a sad note that there was recently a memorial for your well-regarded mom here in Cambridge. She recently passed, and you have our condolences.
Well, thank you. She was a wonderful lady, and
yeah,
I miss her very much.
She was quite something. Well, to the matter at hand, what do you read in the uptick in violence in Baghdad?
I think this is part of the normal cycle. There may be some effort after the U.S. election on the part of the Sunni insurgents, the al-Qaeda types, to demonstrate that they're still around. But we'd have to wait and see if there's going to be a sustained increase in violence.
Well, let's put the exclamation point on this. You have said you think the war in Iraq is lost.
Yes, because a decline in violence is not the equivalent of victory. Victory has to be measured against U.S. objectives. And those objectives are a democratic, stable, and unified Iraq. And Iraq is not a democracy. It's ruled by Shiite religious parties closely aligned with Iran. It has broken up. Kurdistan is a de facto independent country. I don't think that's a bad thing. But you have two competing armies. You have the Iraqi army, which is really a Shiite army, and you have the Sunni Awakening, which is a Sunni army. And incidentally, the Sunni Awakening, while it's been terrific in terms of defeating al-Qaeda and reducing violence, it's not led by Democrats. It's led by Baathists, the very people we invaded Iraq to overthrow in 2003.
And in fact, you write that the goal of the Shiite government is to defang the Sunni militia, the Awakening, to contain the Kurds, which al-Maliki, current prime minister, sees as being way too secular, too Western. And ultimately, the goal of this Iranian-backed Shiite leader is to establish a Shiite Islamic state.
That has been his program. That has been the program of his main political allies. And the only stunning thing is that the Bush administration hasn't seen it. They decided that it was useful to portray Maliki as a Democrat who shares our values. And having portrayed him that way, they've come to believe it themselves.
Given this belief that you have, that this is the situation in Iraq, what to do? What should President-elect Barack Obama do?
I think it's clear what he will do. After all, he would not be president of the United States if it were not for his initial and very strong opposition to the war and his very clear program to withdraw over a relatively short period of time, that is between now and mid-2010. That is his political mandate. I imagine he will carry it out, but it's also the right thing to do.
But let me jump in there, though. Is it, though? I mean, if he withdraws troops from Iraq, doesn't that leave the vacuum for the Iranian-backed Shia government to do exactly what you believe al-Maliki wants
to
do?
The reason to withdraw troops from Iraq is that Iraq is a diversion for more pressing national security challenges, including the challenge from an Iran that is seeking nuclear weapons and from a nuclear-armed North Korea and from the chaos in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Furthermore, President Obama is not going to make enough progress in restoring America's image in the world, which is critical to our leadership, until he gets out of Iraq. Now, withdrawing is not going to create any greater opportunity for the Iranian-backed forces in Iraq than exists now, because those forces are already in power in Iraq, and they were put in power with the assistance of the Bush administration. They're entrenched. So the people who are in charge in Iraq are not going to change whether we're there or not. And the Bush administration had no plan to oust them. In fact, on the contrary, they simply described them as something they weren't.
Well, in fact, you say that they got al-Maliki so wrong that they didn't get his name right initially, that they didn't understand who he was and where he came from. Is there a possibility that, and this would, you know, you'd have to be reading minds to answer this, but is there a possibility that the Bush administration knows full well what is happening now in Iraq and yet needs to define the decline in violence as success in order to ultimately pull troops out?
I'm afraid that there's a political agenda, and that's been apparent for some time. That is that Bush has wanted to run the clock out on Iraq, and the narrative has been set up for the argument that the U.S. was winning at the end of the Bush administration, then the new president came in and Iraq was lost. That is why in my book, Unintended Consequences, I make the argument strongly that the war is lost and that the Bush administration has lost it. To have another political argument like the Who Lost Vietnam argument is not what our country needs right now. And I think the focus ought to be on moving ahead and on some of those things that the U.S. that President Obama can do on the way out. There aren't many, but there are a few things that he can do that would make the situation better.
Well, we're going to find out what some of those might be. By the way, Peter Galbraith has said that the fact that Barack Obama is a man of color with the middle name of Hussein might make him the perfect person to leverage and to negotiate in Iraq. He also says that Iraqi violence may have calmed down because Iraqis believe the U.S. is leaving. They don't see the U.S. as an occupier. We'll have more with Peter Galbraith in just 1 minute here and now. We're speaking with Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and former advisor to the Kurds in northern Iraq. His latest book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. And Peter, before the break, you said there are things President-elect Barack Obama can do as he pulls the American forces out of Iraq as expected. What do you think those things are?
Well, first would be to resolve some of the disputes between the different groups in Iraq. There is the territorial dispute between the Kurds and the Arabs over Kirkuk, the mixed city in northeast Iraq. And the U.S. has a lot of leverage and influence with the Kurds. So a strong diplomatic initiative is something that could accomplish results.
Are the Kurds going to be asked to give up something? Is that what you're saying?
The Kurds certainly are not going to be able to achieve everything that they believe should be part of Kurdistan. On the other hand, there are purely Kurdish areas that they control that are beyond what are today the official borders of Kurdistan and which under the Iraq Constitution should be decided by a referendum. So I think this is a problem that is capable of solution. and would reduce what I think is really a rising danger of violence between the Iraqi government and the Kurdistan government.
We also saw we've already seen some incursions of Iraqi troops into Kurdish areas in September.
Yes, Maliki sent troops into Khanaqin. Now, that isn't formally part of Kurdistan, but it's been administered by the Kurds since 2003. It's purely Kurdish. It was stable. This was creating a provocation where there was no need for one. And that's why it seems to me that it's important to define the boundaries, to demarcate what territory belongs to whom.
So step number one, you say a president-elect Obama can force some of these issues, force some of these compromises. But what else can he do?
Well, and the second one is to work out a modus vivendi between the Shiite government and the Awakening. That's going to be more difficult. We like the Awakening because it defeated al-Qaeda, and that is in our interest. But the Shiite government sees the Awakening as a much bigger threat than al-Qaeda. After all, al-Qaeda couldn't have taken power, but the Awakening is a 100,000-man militia led by Baathists. It is a real threat to them.
These are the Baathists are the followers of Saddam Hussein that the U.S. overthrew in the invasion, and so they are now backing the same people that they overthrew, and al-Maliki Shiite government can see this. You write that the U.S. officials had tried to get Maliki to take some of these Sunni Baathists and to integrate them into the Iraqi army, but it's not working.
Well, the Iraqi government has learned that it can provide commitments to the Bush administration, and then it doesn't actually need to do anything that it promised. So it has said that it will start to pay, I think as of the 1st of October, the salaries of half the Awakening militiamen, and it will integrate a number of them into the armed forces. In fact, it's integrated almost none of them into the armed forces, and this was very predictable. It is now reducing significantly the salaries, the monthly salaries of the people on the payroll of the Awakening, and they're complaining, and they're threatening to go back into opposition to the government.
So how does that get resolved?
Here, too, this is something that would require a major American diplomatic initiative. It may not succeed, but I would have a robust negotiator, somebody like Richard Holbrooke, working with these factions in a very intense way to define, as between the Awakening and the Iraqi government, spheres of influence so that they can coexist. The last thing that we want is an escalation of Sunni-Shiite violence, which in turn would give an opportunity to al-Qaeda.
Peter Galbraith, tell me some good news about Iraq.
Frankly, clearly it is good news that violence has declined and that al-Qaeda is very much weaker. And so there's what we feared in 2006, that al-Qaeda would have a base in the Sunni areas from which it might plot attacks on the rest of Iraq, on the United States. That danger has very much receded. The difficulty is if you don't have a modus vivendi between the Sunni militia and the Iraqi army, then there'll be new opportunities for al-Qaeda. Beyond that, though, I think that there's an opportunity now for the United States to regain its global leadership, what we enjoyed in the final years of the Clinton administration with President Obama. Just the fact of his election has clearly electrified the world. There's enormous relief that the Bush administration and the neoconservatives are finally gone. But he has to now do things, and one of the things the world expects him to do is to get out of Iraq, and I think that if he's going to be able to do much else on his foreign policy agenda, that is going to have to be a very high priority.
And what do you say to Americans who, listening to you, might think, well, wait a second, you're a partisan, you endorsed Obama. It's hard for them because they see the deep decline in violence, and so they think, as John McCain said, that that's success. And they worry that, if U.S. troops pull out too soon, that will be a loss, not just on the scoreboard, but in, the country falling apart. So it's very confusing. Boy, it's such a simple thing to say. Why should we believe you that this is the situation in Iraq?
Well, I would disagree that my analysis is partisan.
It could be viewed that way.
Well, the fact is it's based on observing the situation in Iraq, which I've done for 25 years. And it's a country I first visited in 1984. I've been all over it, both in Saddam's time, when in the Kurdish north. I was there during the uprising in 91. and many times since 2003. And so what I write is how I see it. And I would say that if you look back at my writings, but my track record is much better in terms of predicting what was going to happen than what the Bush administration had been saying. And the problem is, you can only believe that we're on the verge of success if you believe that Maliki and the people around him represent the kind of values that we believe in, and that they're going to create the kind of state that we would like to see. And if you believe that, then yes, I would say that you could argue there's a success. But I think that if you take a look at him and look at the people around him, that's a very dubious proposition.
Peter Galbraith, Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. His latest book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Ambassador Galbraith, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Very good to be with you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, as Barack Obama prepares to move into the White House, in homes across America, parents are raising biracial kids. We'll hear from two moms trying to get it right. Also, a preview of a new PBS program in which Jewish prisoners at Auschwitz put God on trial. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, gun store owners doubling their sales after Barack Obama's election. After the news, Here and Now. Thousands of people took to the streets across California last night to protest the passage of Proposition 8, the amendment to the state constitution that bans marriage between same-sex couples. Voters approved that measure on Tuesday by a 52-48% vote. In Los Angeles, several people were arrested, but the police department said the demonstration was largely peaceful. Well, as many as 18,000 couples tied the knot in California since same-sex marriage was legalized there earlier this year, and it's unclear what will happen to them. Their supporters have already filed lawsuits asking the state Supreme Court to overturn the ban, but ban backers say such a move would subvert the will of the voters. Today, a couple in the middle of this fray, joining us from their home in Columbus, Ohio, are Marion Steger. Hi, Marion.
How are you, Robin?
Good. And Lisa Zellner. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Robin.
They were married in San Francisco City Hall on August 4th. And Marion, let's start with you. California Attorney General Jerry Brown says he believes the marriages between couples like you and Lisa that took place before Tuesday will remain valid. But legal challenges to his ruling from opponents of same-sex marriage are expected. First of all, what happens then? Are you, as the married couple, expected to defend yourself? Is there, if there's a legal challenge, or has the state told you they will defend it?
We haven't heard anything from the state, although we believe there would be actions to try to defend it. Well, I don't think we would personally have the time and ability to go to California and pursue this. We would certainly be interested in joining any class action group that would want to preserve our marriage, and you know, we would do that in whatever way we could.
Some couples who are married in California, as you were, say they will go to court to make sure their marriages remain legal, so there are at least some individuals already starting to think about going to court. But how does this all make you feel? I mean, do you suddenly feel, you know, less married, or is, you know, do you feel in jeopardy?
This is Lisa. We really did this to pursue the legal rights, which is all I think that this movement is seeking anyway, is the legal right to the same benefits as everyone else in this country.
Well, Lisa, hold up a second, and either of you jump in to answer this question, though, because you live in Ohio, a state which doesn't allow same-sex marriage and doesn't recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. So what are the legal benefits you accrue if the state doesn't allow, you know, doesn't recognize same-sex marriage?
Well, that's true, Robin, and it's difficult in Ohio because our marriage license legally doesn't mean anything here. But, you know, for simple things like joining the gym, being able to show a document so we can get the family membership, we now have a marriage license to show, and most businesses will recognize that.
And Marianne had some surgery this summer. A legal document like a marriage license from any state, I think, would have been helpful for us in the event that the doctors or the hospital where she was refused to allow me to be there and support her. And, you know, it's odd. We would have to now in Ohio, we would have to travel to either coast, either California or Massachusetts, to be able to have a state recognize our marriage. But we could drive a couple of hours north and go into Canada, and all of Canada would recognize our marriage license, as would most of Europe.
Mm-hmm. So just to pick up on some things you've said, because there are hospitals that won't allow a same-sex couple to visit each other in the hospital. And there are other benefits as well. I mean, Social Security, for instance. You mentioned Canada. Is that your long-term hope, that this becomes a federally recognized issue?
The reason we we wanted to get a legal marriage was our hope that eventually there'll be federal legislation that will recognize same-sex marriages. There are parts of Social Security that you have to be married for 10 years for spouse benefits to exist. And so, you know, we want to get the clock rolling.
Well, here you want it to be a federal issue. It doesn't look as if it's heading in that direction. Marianne, I want to stay with you. Both of you worked for Barack Obama, but he does not support same-sex marriage. And his name on the ballot reportedly helped draw blacks to the polls in California, who, 7 out of 10, voted to ban same-sex marriage, as did Latinos, also drawn by Barack Obama, also more against same-sex marriage than white voters. Is that kind of a bittersweet thought?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, we both worked very hard on the campaign, but I believe he believes in equal rights. I think he also believes that marriage, from a religious point of view, is certainly a decision churches have the right to make. But the civil legal rights are things that our government should be involved with, and things like Social Security and tax benefits and inheritance law, because you're not legally married as a spouse who can't legally be married, have to pay taxes, those kinds of things when one passes.
But what if you had that, but it wasn't called marriage? Is that good enough for you?
In this country, when you say marriage, I think people immediately think of churches, and that is not at all what we're talking about here. You know, in Europe, marriage is not so much about the religion, it's about the legal civil right that you get from your government. You know, I think if we could separate that somehow here in the United States, then we could have the discussion on a more equal playing field.
Huh. Marianne, one last question. Amendments to ban same-sex marriage were also approved by voters in Florida and Arizona. In Arkansas, unmarried couples can no longer adopt children or become foster parents, and the backers of that legislation in Arkansas made it very clear that they were trying to target gay people. Were there any bright spots in this election for you?
Oh, yeah, I think there is. And I mean, I really think these kinds of initiatives are the last gasps of a dying dragon. And we always take the long view, and I really think we now have a president who is going to help this country look at this issue in a different light. So I am feeling more optimistic. I think we'll get where we need to be in this country.
And Lisa, one last question. You made an interesting point that there are people, secular people, who don't view marriage as a religious institution, and that maybe changing that perception a little might change some of the debate on same gender marriage. But what do you say to people who say, well, it's not that for me? It's just a fear that this is going to erode the traditional family, and I'm trying to hold mine together. Do you have any sympathy for those people?
Only in the fact that, you know, the conservative folks that are pushing against extending equal rights to us or to any other group really hinge their arguments on fear. There is nothing about my relationship and, you know, my love for Marianne and in our partnership that impacts anyone else's family. This is really about us. And standing in City Hall in San Francisco that day, you know, with the Justice of the Peace was a really profound moment. We were just able to stand there and face each other and say it in a government building that we love each other.
That's Lisa Zellner. She and Marianne Steger were married in California and live in Columbus, Ohio, and are waiting the fallout from the new ban on gay marriage in California just passed on Tuesday. Lisa and Marianne, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And here's some other election news. Barack Obama has won the state of North Carolina. Only Missouri now remains too close to call. And we began today by talking about the endangered moderate wing of the Republican Party. There is now one less. The outcome of the Senate race in Oregon has been determined. Democratic challenger Jeff Merkley has defeated Gordon Smith, a moderate Republican who was seeking his third term. Smith was the lone Senate Republican on the Pacific Coast. Last year, he was one of two Senate Republicans voting in favor of a resolution supporting the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. With three other Senate races still undecided, Merkley's victory in Oregon brings Democratic gains in the Senate to at least 55, short of the 60 votes needed to overcome any Republican filibusters. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Well, Barack Obama's win has provoked joy and a run on gun stores. The FBI is reporting that gun sales are up 10% over the same time last year. Duane Irwin is owner of the Cheaper Than Dirt gun store in Fort Worth, Texas. Duane, what are customers saying to you?
They're just in a panic. Most of them realized that back in 94 when the Democrats were in it, they instituted the assault weapons ban. And they just, you know, Barack talked about doing it, and, you know, that's going to be one of his priorities. And people are just, they're terrified. They know it's coming.
So are they buying assault weapons?
They're buying everything. Even 2 weeks ago when the poll showed that Obama was, you know, taking a little bit bigger lead over McCain, people started panicking then. And it's not necessarily just the assault weapons. I mean, that's what everybody sees, but it's just the Glock handguns, ammunition, the semi-automatic AK rifles. 9/11 was our biggest day prior to about 2 weeks ago. The day that happened, we ran $52,000 in sales, which is really good for us. Starting last Wednesday, we started at, you know, 60,000 plus per day, and every day since then, we've increased it. Yesterday, we ran $101,000 in sales. Could have done 150, but we're starting to run out of product. Manufacturers are out, distributors are out, and, you know, the shelves are just, you know, they're empty.
This is good for you to have this record sales, you know, over $100,000 in sales and guns in one day. This is your town. Are you at all concerned about having, what would that be? I'm trying to add it up, you know, maybe $500,000 worth more guns in your town?
It doesn't bother me. I mean, we do extensive background checks. We use the NICS background check the FBI provides. Then we get some people that are delayed or denied. You know, we pass that along to ATF and they take care of business on that part.
Huh.
It's not the guns that do the killing, it's the bad guy behind the gun.
Well, and so gun supporters say. And yet, you know, this fear of Barack Obama, he has said that he supports the Second Amendment rights of gun owners. He favors what he calls common sense restrictions, making guns childproof, better tracking of guns sold at gun shows. He does support making the ban on assault weapons permanent. But otherwise, for anti-gun activists, he's way too supportive of guns.
Oh, absolutely not. He's going to be pro-Second Amendment, you know, while he's running for president. But he picked Joe Biden as his VP, and Mr. Biden, you know, he was the author, one of the co-authors of the original assault weapons ban. So it's going to happen. You know, I think it's all smoke and mirrors when they talk about, oh, yeah, we're common sense regulation. Whose common sense is that? Is it ours, the gun owners, or is it people that are anti-gun? I'm not on the fence. I'm on my side, but it's the folks that are on the fence that bother me.
Well, I mean, and can you maybe see that there might be a difference between concerns about guns in the inner city and concerns about guns in, you know, Texas or Colorado, where we're seeing that gun sales are also going through the roof at places like Aurora's Firing Line Gun Shop or the Gun Room, which I actually went to when I was out there for the convention.
The crooks that have the gun, and I'm not saying inner city because we've, you know, I live in rural Texas, and there's bad guys here, too, that steal and rape, rob, and do all this for a living. That's their job, so to speak. Those guys don't come in my store or go in the stores in Colorado and do them because they can't pass the background checks. They break in your house. They break in my house. And then they steal the guns. Most guns used in crimes are stolen guns.
Of course, anti-gun activists would say they're stolen from your customers. Well, and so the less guns in circulation, the less available to steal.
Well, let me ask you this. If we all banned guns today and nobody, you know, the honest guy couldn't have a gun, do you think the bad guys are going to turn their stuff in? He's already a crook.
I guess so. What I'm hearing overall is that your customers are afraid of what Barack Obama is going to do.
They're terrified. And not him necessarily, but, I mean, Democrats own Congress now. And, you know, those guys up there have a long history of this. You know, they have a history of it, and it's going to happen. I mean, there's no doubt that I think we, you know, NRA can do all they want to do, and I'll support them 100%, but I don't think there's any way we can avoid it. I mean, I think the writing's on the wall.
That's Duane Irwin. He's president of Cheaper Than Dirt, Fort Worth Gun Shop. Duane, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure.
So, what is Barack Obama's congressional record on guns? In 2005, he voted to maintain the right to sue gun makers for crimes committed using their products. But he also voted in 2006 in favor of a measure to prevent police from seizing people's legal firearms during times of crisis. Obama has also said that he supports criminal background checks at gun shows, and he wants to permanently reinstate the assault weapon ban that expired in 2004. Well, up next, Wicked author Gregory Maguire takes on the Cowardly Lion. That's in 1 minute. You're listening to Here and Now. Many of us read Frank Baum's classic Wizard of Oz and thought, wow, that green witch is scary, what with the flying monkeys and all. But author Gregory Maguire read Oz and thought, what is up with that green witch? How did she get that way? In Wicked, Maguire's first book in his series of fairy tales for grown-ups, he explores that question. We learn that it wasn't easy being green for Alphaba Thrupp. She grew up with discrimination, became a passionate animal rights advocate, freeing a caged lion cub during a college science class, only to be later accused of robbing that lion of his courage. You can see where this storyline is going. Her stuck-up college roommate went on to become Glinda the Good Witch, Alphaba forever tarred as the Wicked Witch of the West. Well, she had a son, Lear. His life is explored in Maguire's second book in the series, Son of a Witch. And in the third, well, remember that lion cub that Alphaba released? Gregory Maguire tells us what happened afterwards in A Lion Among Men, and he joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
What fun to read this. Now, the lion's name is Burr. Remind us why?
Well, it is partly because when he was a cub in Shiz University, he shivered so much that was the sound he made through his flopping, scared little lips. But also, I wanted to tip the hat just a little bit to Bert Lahr.
I do believe in spooks. I do, I do, I do, I do, I do, I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. I do, I do, I do, I do, I do, I do.
I look back at the film, which, of course, is where we get most of our visual images for this story, and I see a lion who doesn't look anything like the King of Beasts. He looks like a man in lion pajamas. And I think, what is going on with him? In my novel, I don't say that he's a man in lion pajamas. He clearly isn't. But that was, in a sense, the spur to make me think, who is he behind what we've been told?
Well, he really is a lion, and was perhaps abandoned by his parents. He's not sure, but as a cub, he's wandered through the jungle thinking that. And everything he encounters, he screws up.
Well, it took me a while, even writing the book, before I realized it isn't just enough that he happens not to have a lioness or a lion king, as it were, mm-hmm. a father, to show him the limits and reaches of what it's like to be the king of the forest. He actually grows up without a tribe, so he has to pick up language, such as he does, from the wandering minstrels and lost trappers and soldiers who occasionally skirt through his terrain.
In fact, I want you to do a little reading for us. This is right after one of those soldiers got caught in a bear trap, actually, and dies, even as Burr, is sort of circling him and thinking, well, what should I do? What should I do? You can even hear Bert Lahr, oh, what should I do? Can't do anything. And the soldier dies. But what does happen in that moment is Burr realizes he can talk.
He'd gone 6 days or more, practicing conversational gambits aloud. Hello, I'm very new in town. Hello, are you very in need of a new friend, one with prior experience? When he crossed through a thicket to the edge of a blueberry patch. The fruit hung heavy, cobalt and black and pink. And a small creature, perhaps the size of a human cub, was driving its snout through the offerings. Burr couldn't help himself. You must be very brave out here all alone in the woods, he began. The cub froze and turned an eye like a blueberry upon the lion. Burr straightened his shoulders and tossed his head to aerate his mane into magnificence, whereupon the cub fell to the ground on its back, its small stained paws cupped below its furry chin. Sweet Lurlina, said Burr, I'm slaying them right and left with my conversational wit. He went up to look closely. The cub wasn't dead, but shamming. Burr could see it shaking like a butterfly in a draft.
And the cub wasn't a human cub, but a bear cub of a very forgetful group of bears. Just one of the many encounters that Burr makes. He gets in the middle of, well, it could be called genocide, definitely sectarian violence, violence against trolls. When they're attacked by a mob, Burr, the lion, just folds. One of them says to him, what kind of a lion are you anyway? And it's just event after event where he just, whatever, self-worth he had, it just erodes.
What I was hoping to explore in this book was the sense of imprisonment that we all feel, especially recently with developments in chromosomal science, the imprisonment we feel about how much our actions are predictable because of what we inherited from our folks, maybe from our whole species or maybe from our ethnic groups. Given that predictability, is there really anything left of free will?
Because it's expected of a lion that you'll be more than that. But at a certain point when he realizes that he's not going to be that roaring lion, he never expects anything more of himself.
No, that's true. He finds he has a taste for fine art. He has a good eye for prints, and he can make a cozy little business on the side advising ladies of a certain age on how to decorate their salons. He's not much of the lion that we think of in the middle of the jungle.
No, no. Anyway, as the story unfolds, there are also laws that oppress talking animals in Oz in order to avoid jail after a series of events. Burr is sent to track down Yackel the Oracle and find out, answer questions that have to do with your first two books but are presented, you know, stand on their own. What happened to the Wicked Witch's boy, Lear? What does the Clock of the Time Dragon tell us about all of this? The Clock of the Time Dragon, it's this clock with a dragon that gets dragged through Oz.
Yes, and it tells the future a little bit, just as an oracle can tell the future. And there's another way of examining the same question. If oracles can tell the future, if the clock itself can put on little puppet shows that will tell people who are watching what they are like and what they are about to do, then how much free will do we have in the scope of our own lives to make any difference?
Yeah. Gregory Maguire, what are we left to think about the lion when all is said and done?
He is a lot like us in this particular day and age. Oz, for me, seems to be the best metaphor we have for the United States right now. We have this broad land of different parts that is very much focused upon itself and doesn't think about what lives beyond its own boundaries. So the lion, for us, right now, is a kind of citizen stumbling through, partly in thrall to the government and partly in thrall to his own hopes that he can, in fact, be the savior of his own life.
But he's an animal himself, so there are times when he plays the part of the minority. He thinks that he's made it at a certain point in his life in society, and then he realizes the joke's on him. They don't really accept him at all.
He's a bit of a collaborator. My agent reading this book called me after he reached the last page and said, he sounds to me like somebody who is still standing in about 1948, having expected not to make it through the early 40s in Europe.
And he had to make a lot of compromises to have made it.
Yes, and he has to live with himself because of knowing what has happened because of the compromises he's made. A lot of the book is a flashback, but when the book starts, he is almost a person who has plea bargained with the government to go do a slightly unseemly job for them in order to avoid being sent to prison. On the way, he decides, maybe I can make this work for me. But he's decided that so many times before, and he's never been able to do it before.
Right. You read to find out if he can. That's Gregory Maguire talking about the third book in his series that is homage to Frank Baum's Wizard of Oz. His book is A Lion Among Men, finally explaining why the cowardly lion is so cowardly. Gregory, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Yeah, it's sad, believe me, missy, when you're born to be a sissy without the feminine vibe. But I could show my prowess, be a lion, not a mouse, if I only had the nerve. I'm afraid there's no denying I'm just a dandelion, a fate I don't deserve. I'd be brave as a blizzard.
I'd be gentle as a lizard.
I'd be clever as a gizzard.
If the wizard is a wizard who will serve,
then I'm sure to get a brain,
a heart,
a home,
the knife.